please the court. My name is Robin Fox. I'm here on behalf of Dr. Bacallo and St. Louis University in this appeal. This appeal is from a medical malpractice case where a judgment was returned in favor of the plaintiff in the amount of $825,000. The case was initially appealed to the Eastern District, which reversed the judgment and remanded the case for a new trial. The basis for the reversal and the basis for the application to transfer is the admissibility of a videotape. It's Exhibit 35, which is a videotape of a local newscast of the plaintiff that occurred back in 2001.
Did you seek any kind of limiting instruction?
No, we did not. We did not think it was admissible for any purpose, and therefore we didn't ask for a limiting instruction. We did object.
So it was a local newscast. It wasn't produced by the plaintiff and edited by the plaintiff. It was a local newscast.
No, it was a local newscast edited by that organization that was taken several years before the events occurred in this case.
But the newscast means that the news company had to approve it or put it on. I mean, they just don't put whatever anyone gives them on TV, do they?
Well, we could debate that, but that's a joke.
Okay.
Briefly, just to give a brief timeline, because I think it's important with the videotape. The patient suffered a stroke back in April of 2000. And then he sustained a fall while he was visiting in Oklahoma in December of 2001. He was hospitalized in December in Oklahoma in an emergency room, and then again in January at St. Louis University. In February of 2002 is the first time he saw Dr. Bacallo. He was called in for a consult. He had been admitted to the hospital because of some digestive problems, but Dr. Bacallo saw him as an orthopedist. The allegations of negligence relate to that February 2002 visit, which was the allegations of negligence are a failure to do a hip exam and a failure to do a hip x-ray. Basically, they're alleging that Dr. Bacallo should have diagnosed a hip fracture at that point in time. The hip fracture was subsequently diagnosed in March of 2002. We contended, as the Eastern District agreed, the videotape of the newscast was not practical, instructive, or calculated to assist the jury in understanding the issues in the case.
Why wouldn't it have been helpful to assist the jury in assessing the damages related to his injuries?
It was not helpful because it depicted Mr. Segroy following his stroke and in his state of recovery in 2001. After that, he sustained a fall and was in rehabilitation for a while. And in 2003, he also sustained an unrelated neurologic injury to his lower leg that prevented him from walking. None of the doctors testified at trial that had the hip fracture been diagnosed in February of 2002, he would have returned to the condition as depicted in the newscast. He had several events that occurred since then. So it was misleading to the jury to try to use that to establish damages because there's no indication he would have returned to that condition.
Didn't he at first return to it, but then he got worse?
He did return to that condition following the fracture in the hip replacement in 2003, but in December of 2003, he had an unrelated neurologic problem with his tendon that prevented him from walking, and plaintiff's expert agreed with the conclusion of the neurologist that his inability to walk was related to this neurology problem from the stroke and not from the hip replacement. So we're contending that the depiction in the video does not accurately reflect his condition or what was lost.
I think opposing counsel also argued that it's relevant to show his mental ability because he had suffered some losses later on and so the jury couldn't get from his deposition an accurate assessment of his mental acuity at the time.
Yes. Now, the videotape, it does not just contain statements from Mr. Segroy. It contains statements from a Dr. Erker, an unidentified healthcare worker, the newscaster, and Mr. Segroy's wife. So I'm not sure why those other statements by those other individuals would be relevant to that issue. But leaving that aside, Mr. Segroy does make two statements in the video newscast or news story that was shown to the jury. Those statements aren't responsive to any question. They're just statements that are made. There's no indication that he's following instructions or responding to a question, so they really don't establish his abilities.
Assuming, just for the purpose of this question only, that we were to find that the videotape should not have been admitted or should have been more limited, or I know you talk a lot about not having audio, why was it so prejudicial that it would require a new trial?
I think it was very prejudicial because it contained evidence that could be classified as character evidence. He talked about why he wanted to run for political office, how he could sympathize with other people because he had a lot of pain in his life and he wanted to help others. He talked about the need for universal health care and how he wanted to get that in place to help other people. So it had...
Would that have been okay for him to talk about if he had been examined at trial?
I don't believe that that would be relevant to the issues in the case. His political beliefs and his aspirations in fulfilling those beliefs would not be relevant.
If he was talking about things he wanted to do that the injury had prevented, like he could no longer ski and no longer boat and he could no longer run for office and do those kind of things,
I think
wouldn't
to
it
that
be
limited,
relevant there?
I'm sorry, Judge. Yeah. But to that limited extent, I think it would be admissible. But when he starts to talk about his personal beliefs and how he wants to help people and his views on universal health care, I think at that point it does go beyond.
But I'm not sure how that's prejudicial because, I mean, universal health care is obviously a very controversial topic and there are probably just as many people on one side of that issue as the other.
Yeah, but we don't know. I mean, I think that's the problem. Well,
so are you presuming prejudice? Or?
Don't we typically let the trial courts make that determination of whether or not the it's more probative than prejudicial?
There is
and then we just review it for abuse of discretion, right?
Right. It is reviewed under abuse of discretion. But as the Eastern District found, they found that it was an abuse of discretion because it was highly prejudicial. Yeah.
They didn't really state their reasoning, though, did they? It was about one sentence long.
Well, they talked about that. It misled the jury in terms of the damages because there was no evidence to indicate he would have returned to that state. And they also talked about the hearsay and the character evidence, and they said that that was highly prejudicial.
And I know you say they had two alternative grounds, but they also relied on this, an issue is discussed extensively in the briefs about whether there's only two subcategories of videotapes that can be admitted or whether the test that you stated earlier is a more broadly applicable test than there just happened to be two circumstances which have previously arisen in reported cases.
Correct. The Eastern District, in its opinion, initially said that it was not practical, instructive, or calculated to assist the jury. Then it went on and said it did not fulfill these two areas where videotapes have been admitted in the state of Missouri, and that's for a recreation of an event at issue or to demonstrate a difficult
scientific. What would be the logical reason to allow it in those two areas but no others if it was otherwise instructive and so forth?
I don't think that the courts have limited. I think that they've recognized that generally these are the two categories where videotapes are allowed because they do assist the jury. I don't think that they have said that these are the only two. They said they generally fall in these two categories, and it did not fall in these categories.
Didn't the court below, though, seem to think if it didn't fall in those two categories, it could not come in, interpret it as a stricter rule?
I don't think so, because it initially used the broad rule and said that it was not practical and instructive, and then it went on to say that it didn't meet these two rules. So I don't think it limited it to that. It used the initial rule and then also further found that it didn't
meet. Is it relevant whether or not it's in those two categories?
No, I think it may help in the analysis because generally those two categories are the ones where they have found it to be.
It helps to determine whether it's instructive and so forth.
Correct.
Was there any way of redacting or editing the videotape to take out the offensive comments and or the judge instructing the jury to ignore the comments regarding health care or whatever?
The video could have been played without sound. In fact, we requested that at one point, that if it just showed Mr. Segroy walking with assistance with his cane, that we would, at that point, we would offer to waive our objection to that because that would remove the hearsay and the character evidence. But that was not accepted by the plaintiff, and it was shown almost in its entirety until Gene Jackson starts to talk again at the end of the tape and was shown with audio. So there was a method to do that, but that was rejected by the trial court and the plaintiffs. So it was shown in full. I'd like to just briefly touch on prejudice because I don't know if I fully responded to Judge Rose Russell's question. We feel that it was highly prejudicial because not only did it contain statements from Mr. Segroy about his goals and what his personal beliefs were and how he wanted to help others, but it also had commentary by Dr. Erker concerning what a great patient he was and how hard he tried. And it also had commentary from the wife and another healthcare provider as well as the newscasters. Now, there is some testimony from the wife that talked about that he did run for political office, but it didn't go as far as the videotape. And in addition, she talked about how hard he worked at recovering from his stroke. But this was different because this was a newscast where the news commentators were talking about it and this Dr. Erker was talking about it. And so I think it's a whole different class of evidence and was more prejudicial because we weren't able to cross-examine those individuals.
Well, were you contesting that he worked hard to recover from a stroke?
That was really not an issue right. in the case, and really that's why we said it wasn't relevant to the case. But, I mean, it talked about his good nature and how he mm-hmm. works there very hard, and that's why we thought it was irrelevant because it wasn't an issue in the case.
How long did the tape run? How much time?
It's a fairly short story. I would think it's less than 5 minutes. Council would agree. It was showed almost in its entirety. It was showed from the beginning where the anchor is talking at the news desk until Jean Jackson starts to talk again at the end in the rehab center before it goes back to the news station. Like I said, we did raise two additional issues about the injection of insurance and juror misconduct. I will just rest on the briefs on those issues unless the court has any questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Do you have that in writing? I mean, print it out?
Not now, but I will make it available after the hearing, if that's okay. I apologize for that.
No apologies.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Derek Potts. I'm from Kansas City. I was the trial counsel for this case. I'm very happy to be here. The videotape, Exhibit 35, was not only relevant, but critical for the plaintiffs to be able to show. The first reason was that it showed his prior physical condition, which was repeatedly pointed to by the defense throughout the trial. I have before you two pieces from the opening statement of the defense in the transcript of this case.
You could talk up just a little bit.
Sure. I have before you two portions of the defense opening where they made this issue highly relevant. They continued to point to Mr. Segrois' prior physical condition and related it to various defenses throughout the case.
Weren't the broken shoulder was after the videotape, is that right?
The broken shoulder was sustained at the same time as the broken hip.
Okay.
He fell on his left side, broke his shoulder, broke his hip. They continued to point to his prior physical condition throughout the trial as affecting many things that report to us throughout the case, including the basic allegation of damages that the man required a prosthesis as opposed to a simple pinning.
Opposing counsel says that it was conceded by everyone that the reason he couldn't walk was a neurological problem that was separate and apart from the issues that are the subject of this suit.
I don't entirely agree with that. The reason he couldn't walk was he had his entire hip joint removed, which was completely related to the defendant's negligence. By the time of trial, this may be a
timeline. By the time of the trial in 2007, he was laid up in a hospital bed in St. Louis, had just had his entire hip removed due to an infection that was directly related to the negligence of the defendants. He'd lost the entire capacity to walk. He'd lost the capacity to sit up in his bed. He'd lost the capacity to get in a car. So to say that at the time of trial, it unfairly did not show his condition is not completely accurate. True, before he got the hip infection, he had lost the ability to walk due to some other cause, a neurologic condition. But that was not the only issue. He'd lost the capacity to walk, and his ability to walk had, before he got the infection, related to the defendant's negligence, waxed and waned for many years. And so it was more than that.
So what could he do before the infection that he could not afterward?
He could get in a car. He could sit up in bed with assistance. He basically lost the connection between his big leg bone and his pelvis because of the defendant's negligence.
Is there a risk from the admission of the videotape that the jury would think, absent the infection, he would have been like he was in the videotape, where he was clearly much more mobile?
Well, there's always a risk, but I think that goes to weight, not admissibility. I think they had the ability to explain and do whatever they wanted.
Something I want to demonstrate here is this video was provided to the defense in discovery in 2004. They had 3 years prior to trial to do anything they wanted to attack what was in that videotape, which was very short.
Why would they have been required to have attacked it before trial if they were simply going to object to it at trial?
Well, the defense raises issues about particular people not being able to cross-examine them. They certainly could have taken their depositions. For example, Mr. Segroy was deposed by the defense right before trial. In fact, he was cross-examined by them about his ability to run for office. They chose not to play at the trial for strategic reasons, but he was cross-examined. Ms. Geary was cross-examined.
Why were the parts of the videotape that did not involve Mr. Segroy relevant?
There are several parts of the videotape. And my second point was that with the audio portion goes to his mental condition. There were also his wife on there. There was a physician on there who briefly spoke and frankly said things that were not helpful to us, who said that his stroke was so bad that he's lucky to be back or something to that extent. So we didn't play it, and this goes to hearsay, we didn't play it to prove the truth of the matters asserted. That was we played it to show his ability to communicate, his ability to walk. That reason alone. The other issues, I don't think the doctor, what he said was relevant or irrelevant. It was about something that had happened prior to anything involved in this case. It wasn't the issues or the parties involved. The defense certainly had the right to object to particular parts of the audio portion, which they did not. If you look carefully at their objection, they agreed in the objection that it was relevant to show his physical abilities. Then they objected to the entirety of the audio portion. They could have said, well, let's take out the doctor and leave Mr. Segroy. They didn't attempt to do anything like that. One thing I really want to stress, character evidence was a creation in the Court of Appeals. The word character does not appear in the trial transcript. It does not appear in the motion in limine on this issue. It does not appear in the motion for new trial. It is a completely new argument that was not raised at the trial court level. And I think this court should totally disregard it because it was waived and not timely made. This, as the court knows, trials are complicated, context-based events. Everyone is different in an infinite number of ways. In this case, the judge carefully reviewed the tape out of the presence of the jury, reviewed what had transpired in the trial to that point, including defense arguments that he was not only suffering from such a terrible prior mental condition that he would have needed a more severe operation anyway, but then he had psychiatric problems and was unable to follow directions. The implication being it was hard to diagnose the hip fracture at the time. Trial court knew all this, had seen how the trial had unfolded, reviewed the videotape, considered that Mr. Segroy could not come to trial, considered that they'd had two chances to take his deposition, had videotaped them both, watched the tape and then redacted the very end of the tape where some comments are made about Mr. Segroy's battle with HMOs and some other insurance denial issues that would have been prejudicial. Cut those out, but allowed the rest short version of the tape to be played in its entirety. It was obviously useful for the jury to see Mr. Segroy's prior physical condition, certainly in light of the way the defendants had opened the door throughout the trial.
Whose obligation was it to show any differences between that physical condition and what he was like absent defendants' alleged negligence?
Well, I think it's intrinsically the plaintiff's burden of proof in the case. But how we react in large part at trial is often dictated by the defenses that are raised. And if they make a particular defense, we need to respond with some evidence that rebuts it. Since Mr. Segroy can't come into trial, how do we do that? I guess we could call a neighbor to come in and say they had seen him back 6 years earlier and try to recall what he looked like. This takes me to a policy argument I'd like to an example. You know, if that neighbor had had some testimony about seeing Mr. Segroy in his yard in 2001 and then happened to have a video phone with him and had videotaped him doing some yard work, would the court let him testify but not show the videotape to the jury? It doesn't make sense. And the two categories don't make sense. And at a minimum are confusing to practitioners in trial courts because it's not clear. Obviously, some courts are choosing to use those as rigid categories. The only time you can admit video evidence, when this court has never said anything to that effect. has said something different than that in the Gross case after those two principles had come along in the Court of Appeals.
Can you distinguish the Gross case?
Well, the Gross case was a recreation of a trucking accident. I think it was pointed out earlier that this is not a recreation. We had plaintiffs had nothing to do whatsoever with the creation of this videotape. It was created by a news station in St. Louis before we were ever involved in the case at all, and before Mr. Sabroy had even fallen and broken his hip. So the difference between a recreation and simple videotape evidence, I think, is significant.
If you're done with this portion, could you briefly discuss the insurance issue?
Sure. Once again, we're going to an issue of trial court discretion. The trial court found two things. First, that there was no prejudice whatsoever to the defendants by the mention of the word insurance during the question. Second of all, the trial court found that there was no bad faith by counsel. As the briefing, the parties agree, there was an off-the-record discussion held, although it wasn't put in the record. The parties agreed that it occurred. The procedure was followed to a point. Insurance question was asked to be asked. Permission was given. It was agreed there would be no undue emphasis on the question. The company was identified properly, and parties proceeded. The exact verbiage was not discussed, and I can't give you a reason why that didn't happen other than...
It seemed clear that from the transcript, the trial court was kind of surprised that you said an insurance company.
Well, I think obviously there was a disconnect between us and the trial court as to what the question, the form of the question should be. The trial court has obviously discretion for that. I can't reconstruct my thinking any more than to say our intent clearly was not to inject insurance. It was solely to make sure that the jury knew that we weren't talking about the defendant's practice. This is a very ambiguous name, the doctor's company. I mean, that's the name of the company. It's not the doctor's insurance company, it's the doctor's company. And I think our only intent was to make it clear to the jury that when we asked the question, we weren't talking about Dr. Bacallo's practice or Dr. Bacallo's company. It obviously should have been phrased probably differently. But our intent clearly was not that, and as soon as we learned what had happened, he gave up our right, even though offered by the judge, to re-ask the question because we didn't want to risk any chance that it might cause a problem. And the defense has cleverly found something later in the transcript where someone raised their hand to complain about their own insurance rates going up to try to argue that they were prejudiced. Anyone that's tried a personal injury lawsuit knows that that's a question you always get. Had nothing to do with the idea that the doctor may not have had insurance.
Did the trial court find that the question was objectionable simply because it identified an insurance company, or was it because there were multiple questions? There were too many questions.
My impression at the time was that it was the word insurance. That was my impression, and what's in the transcript is what there is.
When it wasn't in the name of the company, that's what gave rise to the issue, right?
Right. It's not the doctor's insurance company, it's just the doctor's company.
And then you go ahead and say insurance.
Well, we said, we identified it as an insurance company, as opposed to the doctor's practice or a company.
You did not ask multiple questions. You just asked one question.
Oh, just the one question. And then the judge gave us the right to re-ask it, take out the word insurance, and we did not do that just because out of caution. We weren't wanting to raise any more issues or questions from any other jurors, which did not occur. One other point on that I wanted to make, too, just as a policy argument. The last time this was reviewed was 1994, I believe, in Ivy v. Hawk. And to suggest that in 2007, the average juror in Missouri does not believe that a doctor has malpractice insurance, I think it's been off touch with times. Jurors know that. It's on the TV every time there's a political campaign, and suggest that a light bulb ding goes off if the word insurance is said is a little out of touch. And it's further evidence that there was absolutely no prejudice to the defendants in this case.
Of course, that could cut against you also, in that a juror might say, I don't mind insurance premiums go up.
Exactly. And the gentleman that said something later on, way in the voir dire, was talking about his own insurance. He had a business and had workers' comp insurance, I assume, and was talking about his own rates going up. To just sum up, you know, the appellants are urging you to find an abuse of discretion on three separate issues. These are all issues that have historically, for very good reasons, been left to the discretion, if not the wide discretion, of the trial court for this court's prior decisions. We're asking you today to recognize that trial courts are in the best position to assess these factual issues and to respect that discretion. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal?
Just briefly on the insurance question. The court did sustain the objection to the question. She did deny the motion for mistrial, but we didn't on appeal go through the record and find a reference to insurance. In fact, when it occurred during voir dire, when the potential juror started talking about how the case could have been settled and how insurance will likely pay the settlement, again, we renewed our motion for mistrial at that time.
But the court did find it was an unintentional, that there was no intent to manipulate the question, that it was in good faith.
The court didn't make a finding on good faith. It just made, it denied the mistrial with an implicit finding that there was no prejudice, but it did not make a specific finding
because
on good faith.
Mentioning the word insurance in and of itself cannot be reversible, because if insurance were in the title, you can mention it.
Yeah,
so it's the only reason you can't, if it's not in the title, is because we don't want to encourage people to try to insinuate more about insurance in the case. The only reason you're being asked a question is to see if there's some sort of conflict.
Right. You're not supposed to highlight it. And so here it was characterized as an insurance company called the doctor's company. So that's what the court sustained the objection to. She said it's improper, in line with Ivy, that you can't characterize a company as an insurance company. Now, if it's part of the name,
how is it more prejudicial to say the doctor's company and insurance company than to say the doctor's insurance company?
Well,
if it were called that.
Yeah, as this court held in Ivy, it is prejudicial because it's highlighting.
Well, tell me how it highlights it more. I mean, I understand that, but opposing counsel said insurance is in the air these days. Everyone's maybe more aware of insurance now than they would have been when the insurance question rules first came into being.
I think it characterizes why that company is important in this case. You know, it's just not a mentioning of the company's name, but its role in this case. It's an insurance company that has an interest in this case. And so in that respect, I think it is prejudicial. Going back to the videotape, it was our contention that it was not admissible for any purpose because it did not accurately depict the damages that were sustained, because there were these other injuries which plaintiff's own experts that acknowledged affected his ability to walk and prevented him from walking from December of 2003 on. And so by showing the videotape of him walking with a cane with assistance, it misled the jury. It was not helpful to assist the jury in understanding the issues in the case. In fact, it presented a false issue to the jury, and that's why we think it was prejudicial. In terms of his ability to answer questions, it was not just the defense counsel that mentioned his diminished capacity after the stroke. In fact, it was a plaintiff who made the initial comment in opening statement, I think it was on page 63 through 69. And it was plaintiff that presented testimony from his neuropsychologist that talked about his deficits since the stroke. So it was plaintiff that put that issue in, and we did not dispute it. So the video was not necessary to refute any of our defenses, but was in fact done after plaintiff had put that issue before the jury.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The case is submitted.